Welcome to Brain Science, the podcast that explores how recent discoveries in neuroscience are unraveling the mystery of how our brains make us human. I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell, and this is episode 133. If you're a regular listener, you know that I love surprises, especially when they upend longstanding dogmas. Today we will be talking with Susana Herculana Huzel, the Brazilian scientist who determined that the human brain averages 86 billion neurons, which is significantly less than the 100 billion number that is ubiquitous in the literature. We're going to be talking about her book, The Human Advantage, How Our Brains Became Remarkable. We will learn about her pioneering method for counting neurons in large brains and discover a few more surprises along the way. Before you listen to the interview, I want to remind you that complete show notes and episode transcripts are available on our website at brainsciencepodcast.com. You can also send me email at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com or submit voice feedback at speakpipe.com/docartemis. I will be back after the interview to review the key ideas and to share a few announcements. Susana, it's great to have you on Brain Science today.
Pleasure is mine, Ginger. Thank you for having me.
Even though most of my listeners don't know your name, they probably have heard about your work, which includes, of course, determining that the average number of human neurons is about 86 billion?
86 billion, not 100.
And your book tells the story of this discovery, and it also explains, oh, and I guess I should mention the name of the book, The Human Advantage, A New Understanding of How Our Brain Became Remarkable. And we're going to talk about this discovery and why it's important. But before we get into that, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this work?
I'm Brazilian. I'm trained in biology. I never thought that I would become involved in neuroscience, essentially because when I was in college, the brain was just not covered. So I only first learned that we actually had a brain when I was in graduate school in the US, supposedly to get a degree in genetics. And from there, I moved on to neuroscience. I actually started working in development. And then when I really learned about more about brains, I decided, well, I want to be a systems neurophysiologist when I grow up. And what that is you essentially, at the time, you would stick electrodes in different parts of the brain and listen in on the neurons firing and try to figure out when they're active and what makes them active. So I got a PhD doing that in Germany, and I moved back to Brazil some years later, thinking, again, radical change of pathway, thinking, well, I enjoy too much reading about different things in neuroscience. What drew me to neuroscience to begin with was that compared to molecular genetics, which is what I had started doing when I came to the US for the first time for graduate school, neuroscience is all over. Your subject doesn't end at the door to your lab. You just go out in the world and there are questions about you and life around you that are just never ending. And it's so easy to find a way to relate them to how your brain works and how is your brain different from the brain of a dog and from the brain of an ant. And yes, ants do have brains. There was one really great thing, well, amongst many, about getting your degree where I was in Germany, which was the Max Planck Institute. They had this tradition of kicking you out of the lab once you were done with the experimental work and just sending you off to the library. Yes, we used to go to the library back then with your laptop so that you would do research for your thesis. So you would have 6 months to sit down and write. And I really enjoy that time reading about all different sorts of topics, but also about the history of neuroscience. And I think that's when I realized that I was too interested in different topics to just become over-specialized in one part of one subject, which is typically what people do when they go for postdocs. So I decided to try for a job in science communication back in Brazil. That's what I did for a couple of years. But then guess what? It actually got me started thinking about science again, because one of the things I learned when I was dealing with the public at a science museum was that 60% of college-educated people in Rio thought that they only used 10% of their brain. Now, that's a myth, but it's a very widespread myth. And I had no idea where it came from. I frankly still don't, even though I looked around for its origin. There's a bunch of interesting stories behind that. But anyway, I found out that one of the possible ways in which that might be true, it still isn't, is that if you opened any textbook at the time, you would read that the human brain is made of 100 billion neurons and 10 times as many glial cells. So you do the math. It's not exactly 10%, but it's close enough that neurons were supposedly about 10% of your brain cells, right? Of course, as if the other 90% didn't do much, right? To which glial cell specialists would rightly roll their eyes. But anyway, that was the essence, that there's 100 billion neurons in the human brain and 10 times as many glial cells. And you know, they're round numbers. Round numbers always look so good. And I realized that we had gotten to the point in neuroscience literature and even the hardcore papers that these numbers were so well accepted that you didn't even need to cite a reference anymore. It was like saying that genes were made of DNA. Mm-hmm. But I got interested in that question. I started looking around in the literature. I started asking around amongst colleagues, do you know where this number came from? And the bottom line essentially was everybody had heard these numbers. Most people even used those numbers in class and taught them. But no, nobody knew where those numbers came from. But the answer always came, but aren't they right? That's what everybody says. So it turned out that just like the public had this myth going on that they only use 10% of their brain, which is frankly a waste, right? That would mean that you walk around carrying 90% of that weight in your body, in your brain. But just like the public had this myth going on, apparently there was a huge myth also going on amongst neuroscientists themselves. I realized that everybody thought that everybody else knew what brains were made of. But once you started digging through the literature, which was what I was lucky enough at the time, I had just gotten a new position at the Federal University in Rio, I had the time to go through the literature and look for those original numbers, and they were nowhere. It turned out that actually nobody knew what different brains were made of, much less how the human brain compared to others. So that's what drove me into all of this.
So you already had the research training to a certain extent, and it was just getting you back into what you had sort of gotten away from. I know not to how to do the thing you ended up doing, but the basics of how to be a scientist, you already had that.
Sure. I had the basic training. And one of the good things about starting in science in Brazil at the time was there were a number of mechanisms in place to ensure that you start working in a lab very early on, almost as soon as you start in college, if you want to. So that was great. And yeah, I had 3 years of training in the US and 4 years of training in Germany. And I think this is where I got really lucky. I never had proper formal training to do what I do now, which means, I think, that I got a very fresh look at the literature when I first started reading about all this. Because I realize now that there are a number of myths, really. There are a number of ideas that are based on intuition, and they're intuitions that make perfectly good sense. It's just that they're only intuitions, but most people don't realize that. I'm still only talking about ideas related to how brains vary in size, how brains grow in evolution, and how different brains compare, and what makes a brain much more folded than the other, how that relates to number of neurons. It turned out that there were a number of very basic concepts, principles, let's say, about what brains are made of and how they're built and how they compare, I mean, what changes, what doesn't change in evolution and diversity, that really were not known, but everybody had ideas about that and everybody thought that everybody else already knew. So that was sort of a dead space in the field because everybody had already moved on to, you know, the fancy optogenetics and the cool design activated receptors and the really cool, fancy, high-tech molecular biology that you can do these days.
Yeah, but actually, that's what I love about your book is that, and why I wish I had introduced it to my listeners sooner, because The Human Advantage is full of many ideas that were new to me, even though I try to follow the field fairly closely. And it really has to do with a lot of these myths that you, let's just face it, you debunk them. We can't talk about everything, so I'm going to try to lead us toward a few high points. But one of the things that you talked about early on in the book was the myth that mammals have, now I may be not putting this exactly right, but remnants of a reptilian brain.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. What's wrong with that idea? Because that's one I was guilty of perpetuating.
I know. And again, that was an idea that I was an intuition that kind of made sense, right? It went very well with this idea that comes from the late 19th century that evolution is progress, that you evolve towards something greater and bigger and better. Right. And in that sense, the idea was that, well, you had fish and reptiles first, and then birds appeared, and then mammals. And of course, within mammals, humans are the crown jewel. Right. But the thing is, as facts come out, and that is what I love so much about facts, you can actually use them and get over people's ideas and preferences and intuitions. You have to find out how the facts make sense. So as new facts turned out, we now know that first, evolution is not progress. All that evolution means is change. It's change over geological time. So it's not for the better. It's not for the worse. It's just different. All it has to do is with generating diversity. So that's the first thing. Evolution is not progress. But second, we now have ample evidence that we are not descendants of reptiles. We are close cousins. We are two unrelated groups, let's say, in the sense that one did not descend from the other, but we do share, let's say, a common grandmother. So saying that we descended from reptiles is exactly as preposterous as saying that we descended from our cousins that have the same age as we do, right? So we're related, but we're not each other's descendants. So what that means to begin with is that we could not have, let's say, a basic reptile brain to which something else was added. But most of all, we know now that this cortex or neocortex, it's a part of the brain that if you recognize that it can be called by a different name, it's the pallium. Pallium means the mantle, so the top part of the brain. Every single vertebrate has it. Reptiles have it. Birds, which actually are reptiles, they're feathered reptiles, they also have it, and very, very well developed, let's say, in a very complex form that is actually structured very similarly to what we have. So there is no such thing as a triune brain. There is no such thing as a reptilian brain on top of which some new structure appeared only in mammals. No, we all have it, reptiles and vertebrates alike. And that's where things start to change once you realize that the brain is very much the same in its essence. The difference lies in quantities. To what extent does one part of the brain or the other, does it grow? How many neurons does it have to actually do the job?
Right. So another one of those persistent myths that your book debunks, and this is kind of the easiest one to take off the surface, is the idea that our brain, human that is, our brain is too big for our bodies, that is, by prediction, that we are somehow the outliers. We have huge, huge, physically huge brains. And this is one of the things you disprove clearly in the book. Before we get into the details, I need you, and this, I think, is to me seems like it could be challenging, is to briefly explain the idea of a power law, assuming for someone who doesn't know anything about it, because I think it's a very basic principle that then carries throughout the rest of the book.
So the essence here is that there are recognizable relationships between the size of different parts of the body. So if you look at a mouse, or if you look at a cat, or if you look at an elephant, you recognize that they all look like mammals. There's this universal, let's say, there's this consistency in proportions, right? Even though the proportions are not exactly the same. So if they were, if everything were exactly the same, then you would have linear relationships across all the different parts that make up a body, right? And you do find that in some cases. For instance, the heart and the lungs seem to be a very constant percentage of your entire body mass, your entire body weight. So that is a linear relationship. So that means that if you're looking at a mammal that is 10 times bigger than another one, it also has a 10 times bigger heart and a 10 times bigger set of lungs. Power laws come in where these relationships are still fixed, but they're not linear. And the brain is a prime example of that. So what you typically find is that a larger animal has a larger brain, but not linearly. So let's say if you look at a rodent, if a rodent that is 100 times bigger than the other, so the body is 100 times bigger, the brain is not 100 times bigger. The brain is only maybe 10 times bigger, let's say. But still, that is a fixed proportion. You can predict how large the brain of a species will be from how large the body is. It's the fact that it's a power law, essentially what that means is that it's not a linear relationship, so that the organ that you're looking at, that part of the body that you're looking at, is not a fixed percentage of the body. Now, having said that, the first thing that that does is it allows you to predict how large a part of the body, let's say the brain, should be, how large you would expect it to be in an animal of a certain size. So if you take all mammals as a whole, you can consider that, well, humans weigh typically something around 70 kilos. So a generic mammal with a body of 70 kilos should have a brain of, let's say, some 200 grams, right? And it's compared to that expected 200 grams for a generic mammal that the human brain has for the longest time been considered to be too big, about seven times too big. So 1.4 kilos as opposed to, let's say, 200 grams that was the prediction for a generic mammal. So human brain is too big. But the thing is, what we realized when we started counting neurons in a systematic way across groups of mammals that you could actually compare to each other, so apples to apples, not apples to oranges, rodents to rodents, primates to primates, it turns out that the way primate brains are put together in a body, that is almost linear. So that means you have a primate that is 10 times bigger, it has a 10 times bigger body. It has a brain that is nearly 10 times bigger as well. So the brain of your typical primate is about 1.5 to 2% of the mass of the body as a whole, humans included. So if you look at the same data that people have been looking at for the longest time, if you consider it that way, you realize that it's not humans that were the exception. It's the very large great apes that were the exception. So the brain of a gorilla is about 0.1% of the mass of the whole body. The same thing with orangutans. Chimps are also well on their way there. So when you look at it that way, it certainly appears very much like it's not humans who are the exception compared to most other primates. It's you have this lineage of great apes that seem to have somehow, let's say, favored a larger body over a larger brain with more neurons. And the reason for that, I suspect, is that when you're a large primate and you have to sleep about 7 to 8 hours per day, and there's only so many hours you can spend in your day looking for food, especially given that every other animal is limited to eating raw food, and that includes gorillas and orangutans, there's only so much energy you get per day. So especially when your body starts getting really large, you're only going to be able to afford either a very large body or a large brain with a number of neurons. It's a trade-off there. So it seems like we went one way and gorillas and orangutans went another way. So their trade-off favored having very large bodies with not so large brains. But that's it. It's because that's what they can afford with the energy that they get.
So you made that simpler than I would have. Tell us about how you actually determine how many neurons there are in a brain.
Well, I'm going to use kitchen terms. The usual way, the traditional way of counting cells is turning brains into carpaccio, let's say. You slice them really thin and you put those slices under the microscope and you determine how many neurons you have per small volume, and then you use proportionality and you estimate if there were this many in that small volume, then in the whole volume there should be these many. But the thing is, that only works when you're dealing with parts of the brain that have a pretty homogeneous composition, meaning the density of neurons is quite similar from one part to the next. And that is just so not true of the brain as a whole. You can have a very high density of neurons in one spot and you move 2 millimeters to the side and there you hardly have neurons at all. So the traditional approach of turning brains into thin slices and counting small pieces would not work for a brain as a whole. And also at the time when I got interested in these questions, when I realized that we actually didn't have numbers, we didn't know the facts about the basics of what brains were made of, I also didn't have a lab. I had just been hired at the Federal University in Rio officially to work as a science communicator. But I was interested in these issues. I was reading through the literature and I found these papers from the 1970s where people would extract DNA from the whole brain. And so you determine the total concentration of DNA in the brain, and assuming that you know the precise amount of DNA that is found on average in every single cell, you could divide the total by that amount per cell, and that would give you a total estimate of how many cells you had in the tissue, which is in principle fine, except that your estimate is only as good as your first number of how much DNA you have per cell nucleus. And I remember looking at that paper and just going, no, don't count DNA, count nuclei, just count the nuclei directly. And I remembered working as an undergrad at the same university, I remember seeing my advisor harvest cell nuclei from cell culture. So I knew that that was a thing. I knew that that was something that you could do, which is just break the membrane of cells, free their nuclei, and collect all the nuclei. So the idea there was that if I can do that, and if as long as every cell has one and only one cell nucleus, which is essentially the case, then if I could count cell nuclei, I would actually be counting numbers of cells without having to deal with this problem of the different densities. So I would be essentially literally doing away with the heterogeneity and the distribution of cells. So you do that by dissolving the tissue in detergent, not kitchen detergent, but something very, very close to it. It's just a regular detergent that every single lab has in their shelves. So you essentially turn your fixed brain of preference into soup in a glass homogenizer, which is really a tube version of a mortar and pestle. You throw your brain there at the bottom, or the part of the brain that you want to look at. You toss in the detergent and you just crush it repeatedly until every single cell membrane is dissolved in the detergent. And that leaves you with a soup, really, of free nuclei. And the thing is, you determine what the volume of the soup is, and you can do that accurately. And then it's a matter of 10 to 15 minutes at the microscope with a fluorescent dye to determine how many nuclei you have per mL of the suspension. So once you know that number, you actually know how many cells you had in the original tissue. And to that point, it didn't even take you an hour.
But I realize, Dean, that step is the short piece. Your first animal was a rat, is that right?
Yeah, I started out with rats.
How long did it take to get your first set of results?
To be convinced that I had a stable method, it was probably about 1 year to figure out all the wrinkles, figure out the details of, do I pour the suspension from one tube into the other, or should I collect it with a tube? It turned out I had to pick it up with a pipette and transfer it to the tube. Otherwise, I could have loss of nuclei just on the walls of the glass vials that I couldn't really afford. So it's the small details in figuring out that the tissue had to be well fixed before you started. Otherwise, you would actually destroy the nuclei. But turned out that as long as the tissue was well fixed, you essentially had no loss. And the good thing about doing the counts under the microscope is that you have your visual quality control right there. You can look at the nuclei and you can see that they are intact, that you have no breakage, that you really have no loss. So yeah, about a year.
And you had, because a rat brain is pretty small, you had, is it stereology? Is that what the other method is called? You had results to compare with for that, right?
Right. I had results in the literature that I could compare mine to. I was still not set up to do stereology. But yeah, that's where we got lucky too. Also that we started out with rodents, rats, mice, guinea pigs, agouti, and capybara. Capybara is a German shepherd-sized Amazonian rodent. And it turned out that the results with rodents were actually quite close to what people had predicted, mostly, again, from intuitions in the literature, and that was that bigger brains should be made of more neurons, yes, but also bigger neurons. And you can estimate that, you can infer that from seeing the density of neurons decline in bigger brains. So that means that you essentially have a lower density means that you find fewer neurons per chunk, per volume of tissue. And essentially the way to get that is by having the average neuron become bigger. So that was exactly what people expected. And we also found that the few numbers that were out there in the literature obtained with stereology, like you said, they did match very well what we had. The difference was that now we could go well beyond that and actually quite rapidly, because we didn't have to turn brains into carpaccio. We could turn them into soup, and probing the soup under a microscope is far easier.
And this is where you come up with the fact that from a standpoint of numbers, the primate brain is different from the average mammal brain.
Exactly, because it turns out that if you compare a primate brain and a rodent brain of the same size, but the expectation originally was that if you're looking at two brains of the same size, they should be made of similar numbers of neurons. And the reason why that's important is that if you consider that neurons are the basic information processing units of brains, then whatever two brains have the same number of neurons, they should also have similar information processing capabilities, right? So that was the expectation. But it turned out that if you had a rodent brain and a primate brain of the same size, especially if they were more on the largish side, what you would see is that the primate brain always has more neurons than the rodent brain. And again, we come back to this issue of power laws or linear functions. So it turns out that a rodent brain scales in size as a power law of its number of neurons with an exponent that is well above one. That means that if you have a rodent brain with 10 times as many neurons as your reference, that brain is not just 10 times bigger. It's actually about 45 times bigger. And that happens because the average neuron becomes larger. So it's a very inflationary way of adding neurons to the brain. Now, it turns out one of the key things we found out, that's only one way of putting brains together. The primate way, for example, of putting brains together is if you have 10 times more neurons, you essentially have a 10 times, at best, an 11 times bigger brain. So you're close to linearity there. And what makes that possible is that in primates, as primate brains gain more neurons, the average size of the neuron doesn't seem to really increase on average. So that means that you have 10 times more neurons that now compose a brain that's only about 10 or maybe 11 times bigger. So it's a very, very economical way of adding more neurons to the brain. So the end result is that if you compare the human brain to what a rodent brain weighing about 1.4 kilos would look like, we certainly seem to have between 7 to 10 times as many neurons as you would expect in a non-primate brain. But that's not because humans are special. That's simply because humans are primates. So that's one of the key findings, that once we could establish other primates as a reference, not mammals as a whole. So once you're back to comparing apples to apples, then you realize that a generic primate brain that weighs about 1.4 kilos, that's us. That's a brain with 80-something billion neurons. So we're that generic primate. I think the huge twist in the story came with, how did our ancestors manage, let's say, to have such a brain with so many neurons when apparently nobody else seems to be able to afford that?
So how many species of brains have you studied so far?
We are nearing 100 species now, because we published last year on a number of bird brains, and they're actually, they have even more neurons in their tiny little brains than primates with a similar sized brain.
They would have to do the stuff that they do with their little bird brains.
Well, that's, I'm glad you think that, but that is new. People used to think that birds were, you know, just dumb. I mean, the expression bird brain didn't come out of nowhere. It came out of this expectation that you have a tiny little brain, you're not going to be able to do much. So yeah, so that's where it's so interesting and exciting to find out that this prediction that we made in the beginning, that it should be numbers of neurons that really matter in terms of your cognitive capabilities, not the size of your brain, and especially not the size of your body. That should be what really matters. So it's really nice to see that bearing out again and again, first with primates against other species, now with birds against even primates, right? And also, we found that the elephant brain, even though it's one thing to find that compared to every other primate and all the other smaller mammals, humans have the most neurons in the cerebral cortex. Well, duh, sure, but what about a really large brain? Do we still have more neurons than a brain that's much larger than ours? And that's where the elephant brain came in. I was lucky to start a collaboration with Paul Menger in South Africa, and he was able to give us a hemisphere, so a half brain of an African elephant whole to work with. And it turned out that, well, I'll give you the full story because it's an interesting twist. The elephant brain as a whole is about three times the size of an average human brain. It's the size of my entire forearm. It's a really huge brain. But still, the expectation that we had at that point was that, well, it's not a primate, so even though it's large, it probably has a relatively small number of neurons compared to the human brain. Turned out, it actually has three times as many neurons as a human brain. But, and this is a huge elephant-sized but, 98% of all those neurons in the elephant brain are in the cerebellum, which is a massively sensory structure. And I think, that's my suspicion, that it has to do with the trunk. Elephants are the only animals to have that huge sensory motor appendage. It's 100 kilograms, so 200 something pounds of pure muscle and sensory receptors. But anyway, so the thing is, What's really exceptional is the number of neurons that you find in the cerebellum of the elephant, whatever they're doing there. When you look at what's left in the cerebral cortex, it turns out that even though the cerebral cortex of the elephant is twice the size of the human cerebral cortex, it only has one third the number of neurons. So we have on average 16 billion neurons in our cerebral cortex. There's variation there, of course, but the elephant had only a bit more than 5 billion neurons in that huge cerebral cortex.
So does that scale like a mammal?
That scales like a non-primate mammal, yes. So the elephant's cerebral cortex has just the number of neurons that you would expect in a non-primate generic mammalian cerebral cortex. Right. So the difference remains that we have a primate-made cerebral cortex with much smaller neurons, or actually, I should say, with neurons that have not become massively larger as they increased in numbers, which is the opposite of what has been happening to other mammals in evolution, elephants included. So our estimate is that the average elephant neuron is 30 to 40 times the size of an average human brain neuron, human cortical neuron.
So you've probably blown quite a few people's minds here with all the things that we used to think were obviously true that aren't true. But what stands out for you as the most surprising thing that you expected to find that you did not?
Well, the first expectation that did not bear out was really about the elephant cerebellum. I mean, the elephant brain as a whole. The elephant is a massive outlier. Not humans, the elephant. The elephant cerebellum is a massive outlier. And that outliers are interesting because they do tell you something that that you didn't expect, that doesn't conform to the rules that you thought you had figured out until then. But just the same way, I had never expected to find homogeneity, so hardly any change at all in how the numbers of glial cells, so the non-neuronal cells in the brain, those hardly vary. The density of glial cells in the brain, actually any part of the brain, any species we've looked at so far amongst mammals, that is very constant. And I was originally trained in biology, and like I was telling you, I like to think of evolution as simply change. It's changed over geological time. And when you find something that hasn't changed like at all in 200 million years of evolution, essentially what that means is one of two things. Either you've run into some biological principle, some biological limitation. You found something that just cannot change. It either works this way or it doesn't work at all. Or else you found a physical property of tissue, of biological tissue. And the interesting thing is that, and I did not expect this at all, because again, evolution means change. And when you study diversity, guess what you expect to find? Diversity, right? So to find something that doesn't change at all was really quite surprising. And we found that in two places, and I think they're each one example of those two different circumstances. Glial cells apparently do not really change in how they're added to the tissue. And yes, there are different types of glial cells. Yes, there is a particular class of astrocyte that seems to vary a little bit in size. But as a whole, when you look at the numbers, it's really impressive. It's really like, I like to say this, you don't mess with the glia. It's like every time evolution has messed with how glial cells are added to the tissue, that animal just dies right there. It's not going anywhere. So that to me is really important because it means that there has to be some basic biological functional principle at play here that we have yet to understand. How come you can't mess with the glia? How come you always have this proportionality between glial cell volume and the volume of neurons in the tissue that seems to be adjusted really depending on how large on average the neurons are? So that is one thing. But the other huge surprise was there was this, again, massive intuition in the field that a bigger cortex has more neurons, and as it gains more neurons, it grows laterally and it folds, right? The idea was that the folding of the cortex, very much like you take the sheets off your bed and you try to fit them in the hamper and they won't, you have to crumple them up, right? You have to fold them up. So the idea was that with cortical expansion in evolution, the same thing happened, that the only way to fit more neurons in a larger cortex would be to fold that cortex more and more, right? Made perfect sense. But again, what we found out was that it was only an intuition based on an expectation that did not pan out, because again, different cortices are made in different ways. So the relationship between how many neurons you have and how wide the surface of the cortex is enormously variable, and people didn't expect that. So the consequence is that how folded a cortex is doesn't really have anything to do with how many neurons it has. So just to give you an example, you can have a pig in a baboon, that's a primate, a pig and a baboon cortex, they are exactly as folded one as the other. But the baboon has 10 times as many neurons in the cerebral cortex as the pig. You can run a different comparison with human and the elephant cerebral cortex. The elephant cerebral cortex is much more folded than the human cortex. So you would expect the elephant cortex to have more neurons. But like I told you, it only has 1/3 as many neurons as humans have. So it turns out that it's always there, right? It will happen regardless of how the cortex is put together. That bit is pure physics. So I think it's really, really interesting to find, as you study diversity, to find that there are some things that just don't change.
So what is the human advantage?
I think it's that, first, we're a primate, so we have a brain that is built like a primate brain, and that means we have this advantage compared to other mammals that we can fit a very large number of neurons inside a relatively small brain. And that's important because, first, your head doesn't become enormous, right? So that means your body doesn't also have to be enormous. But more than that, I think we're able to achieve that advantage of having the most neurons in the cerebral cortex of any species, thanks to technology, one of the earliest technologies that our ancestors came up with. And that was a technology that allowed us to get much more energy from the food that we eat. It very much freed us from the same constraints that to date still apply to every single other animal on Earth, which is everybody else is limited to eating food as is. You eat what you have, without transforming it first. And that was the really cool technology that our ancestors came up with. And it's so important, it's so transformative that we just take it for granted today. And that is cooking. Cooking in the amplest sense of just using tools to chop and cut and mush and puree and just transform foods before you put them inside your mouth. And then, of course, later, once you're able to control fire to soften foods and break down molecules chemically before you put them inside your mouth, that's a game changer. I think that is what allowed us to have this advantage of having 16 billion neurons in the cerebral cortex. That's more neurons than anybody else has. And this part of the brain that is really the essence, let's say, of allowing animals to go way beyond simply responding to stimuli. That's where you're able to find patterns, make predictions, have expectations for the future, make plans to achieve those expectations. So I think that's the human advantage. We have the largest number of neurons in any cerebral cortex, and I think we got there thanks to this technology that our ancestors came up with, cooking.
Right. And I loved it in the book when you said, you know, we feed our dogs cooked food, but their their lives are not particularly cognitively demanding.
Yeah. Well, the thing, too, is They have just get it easy. Fat
if we feed them.
Yeah, exactly. I get this question a lot. So what do you think would happen to gorillas and chimpanzees and orangutans if they started getting fed cooked food? And I think, well, I know what the first thing that happens is they get fat, because all of a sudden they're getting way more energy than they used to, right? And remember the beautiful part about getting more energy in less time with cooking is the advantage that you get with any technology. By definition, you get time. Technologies save time. So you have, once you don't have to spend your entire day looking for food and eating, you get that free time in your hands to do more interesting things. Like right now, the thing is, cats and dogs will spend most of that free time sleeping, right? Which doesn't really get much accomplished. Although you have to grant them, I have dogs at home. They are very good at training us to do what they want, right?
Absolutely. Susanna, I want to ask you a question I ask most of my guests, which is, what advice do you have for students?
Read everything. Read what you agree with. Read what you don't agree with. Read on how things came to be and why do people think things are the way they think they are. But most of all, read critically. Just think of what it is that you're reading and think of for yourself, does this make sense? Do we really know what we think we know? I think that is what moves not only science forward, but it's also what moves people forward. That's how you learn.
Yeah, that 10%, we only use 10% of the brain. That seems like a myth that won't go away. Just a few years ago, National Geographic had a special issue on the brain, and that was one of those myths that appeared in that very issue that I assume they were doing research to make that issue and got it from someone who got it from someone who couldn't tell you where they got it from.
See, that's where critical reading comes in. Yep. That's how I got lucky that I had to start from scratch in this field. I never got formal training to do what I do now. So that means that I really had to start from scratch. I had no preconceived ideas on what brains are made of and how they scale with body size or how they fold or anything. So it's weird, but apparently that becomes an advantage when it turns out that most of what people thought they knew in the field was really just wishful thinking. It's really intuitions. So that's what I encourage my students to do. Just think for yourself. Just don't accept something is so just because a textbook says so. Just ask yourself, do we really know this? How do we know this?
Science is somewhat self-correcting, but I think it requires that each generation have challenged what's gone before.
Yeah, that's the critical thinking part. But see, this is where students at first they just pull their hairs out. What are you telling us, that the textbooks are wrong? I'm like, yes, and isn't that wonderful? That means that we're learning.
People think, you know, I have this brilliant niece who's an art major because she hates science, and I'm convinced it's because the way they teach it in high school is like, it's a bunch of facts. It's not. It's our best estimate of how things work that we have to constantly correct and improve.
Exactly. It's the best theory. It's the best story you can tell at this moment based on the facts that you have. But as you get more facts, you have to revisit your story sometimes. And that is beautiful, because every question you answer just brings up 5 to 10 new other ones. But it's beautiful also because that's how we learn. That's how we change. Thank goodness we don't live anymore like we did in the Middle Ages. And that's all thanks to this ability to gather new facts and revisit what we think that they mean. And it's perfectly fine that it keeps changing. That's the best thing we could wish for, that it just keep changing.
So I know you recently moved from Brazil to Vanderbilt, which is in Tennessee. What are you doing there?
Looking at the next basic things that people haven't looked at for ages. And that starts with energy, how much energy the different brains cost. How do larger neurons really cost more energy than smaller neurons? How much energy does an elephant brain cost compared to a lion, compared to a dog, compared to a human? Does that depend on how many neurons you have, on how many synapses you have? There's a lot of really basic information that we need on that, including to understand diseases and aging and what happens to the brain vasculature and metabolism as we age, as we get sick, but also as evolution happens, what happens there. That's my current favorite piece, let's say, of the brain that we always thought we knew lots about, but turns out we actually don't.
Right. So I appreciated that during the course of your book, as you shared your story, you talked about your collaboration with several senior scientists, one of whom was John Koss. He's at Vanderbilt, isn't he? Or has he retired?
John, no. John is active. John is right here two doors down from me in the psychology department at Vanderbilt. John is the coolest guy. He's a neuroscientist. He works with evolution. I remember walking up to him in the earliest days of coming up with a method to count neurons. I thought we were on to something important, but like I said, I wasn't in this field. So I wanted to have somebody else's opinion on how important it could really be to figure out how many neurons different brains were made of. And I walked up to him and I was at a meeting and said, I think I have this way of figuring out how many neurons you have in different brains. Do you think that is important? And he looked at me for a few seconds and said, that's what everybody wants to know, but nobody can do that. And so a couple of years later, he arranged to have me come to his lab, and that's how we started working on primates. We've been collaborating on primate brains ever since, but we very quickly, in a matter of days, we had the first results, and I remember rushing into his office with my laptop open, showing him, look, we have numbers, and the primates are different. Primates have way more neurons than rodents do with the same size. He was... He just looked at me with a very, very surprised expression on his face going, so it actually works. And I'm like, yeah, you didn't think it worked, did you? And I'm like, no, but you can have anything you want now. And it's been great because John has done so many wonderful things in neuroscience and in evolution. And He decided that he wanted to have fun, and we started collaborating on this, and so over 10 years now.
Yeah, you realize it's a huge blessing to have had someone like him helping you.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, you talked very briefly in there about how resistant people were to those original results.
No, yeah, that makes a world of difference. When you're talking about changing views, introducing new facts and reinterpreting them, of course, it makes a world of difference if you get lucky enough to manage to convince some of the key people in the field. And sure, maybe if you insist enough, eventually people will start agreeing to reconsider their well-entrenched ideas. But it, of course, makes a world of difference to have somebody just embrace this new thinking, this new way of looking at new data, and just revisiting old ideas, old intuitions in the light of new data. And John definitely had this huge role of just gently pushing me forward, pushing me out there. Hey, come here. Come listen to her ideas. You know, he arranged to have me give talks in different meetings. It was through him that I met some of the key people in the field. So that is a part of science that I think a number of people don't realize. There's the social aspect of science. Science is done by people. And of course, there are people you get along with, there's people you don't, there's people who have their own preconceived expectations, there are others that do that, but also are perfectly willing to be convinced by new facts. And it all has to do with dealing with people. And of course, sometimes you get lucky to have wonderful people thrown your way. And I got really lucky to have John appear in my life. So I feel really fortunate that I'm really just two doors down from his office now. It's been a lot of fun.
Great. So is there anything else you would like to share before we close?
Well, if we're talking about science to aspiring scientists or people who are maybe interested in science, I think the really cool thing about science that can interest every single person is it has to do with curiosity, but it has to do with being systematically curious. And that is something that everybody can do in their lives. You know, you hear something, you wonder if it's really true. It's especially nowadays, it's become so easy to look for facts, to just ask for yourself, is this really right? Or can I maybe get some new fact out there that could change my mind? But, and of course, it becomes a challenge of a whole different level when you want to do that professionally. But I think we're still lucky in the U.S. to have, well, for now, to have the means to, I'm not going to say what everybody says, which is indulge that curiosity, because that is just underestimating so enormously the role of science in our lives. Like I said, I'm so thankful that we're not in the Middle Ages anymore. And that to me has to do with one single thing. It's science. It's this systematic questioning of reality. Are things really the way we think they are? Let's gather some facts and let's find out. And that's what got us out of the Middle Ages. And I just so hope we stay away from there.
I'm with you. Well, Susanna, I have so appreciated getting to talk with you. And if any of my listeners want to reach you or find you, how can they do that? Other than, of course, reading your book, The Human Advantage.
So I have my lab has a website. It's SusannaHerculanoHuzel.com/lab. We have all our publications are available there with some general explanation of what we've been doing and what things look like. And my email is also available there. So I tell people I read every single mail that I receive. Whether or not I can reply is a whole other issue.
That's kind of the way I am. So I'm with you there.
Yep.
Well, okay, great. Thanks again.
It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
I want to thank Susanna Herculano-Huzel for coming on Brain Science to talk about her book, The Human Advantage, How Our Brains Became Remarkable. It just came out in paperback, but as far as I know, it's not available from Audible. This is a book that I encourage everyone to read because she shares how science is really done with the skill of a master storyteller. And of course, we didn't reveal all the surprises in today's interview. Besides surprises, this interview also debunked a few long-standing myths. One is the idea that we have a reptilian brain buried deep inside. Mammals are not descended from reptiles. We're more like cousins. Also, our cerebral cortex is less special than we thought because it turns out that all vertebrates have a similar structure, although it may go by different names in birds and reptiles. Susanna argues that the key difference is in the number of neurons. A second myth is that our brains are too big for our bodies. It turns out that primate brains are different from other mammals and that humans have exactly the size brain predicted for a primate of our size. Gorillas and orangutans have unusually small brains. We talked briefly about the idea of the power law, which Susanna called a way of describing the nonlinear relationship between a body part and body size. In her book, she explains how this principle is used to predict the brain size of various animals. It turns out that in most mammals, the brain doesn't grow as fast as the rest of the body. But in primates, the relationship is different. It's almost linear. This means that if you look at a rodent and a primate, With the same body size, the primate will have a bigger brain. However, there is a more important difference between primate and generic mammal brains, and that is that in primates, the neurons don't get larger as the brain gets larger, which means that a primate can fit more neurons into the same size brain. This is something that was totally unexpected and really was discovered after Dr. Herculano Huzel developed what she calls her brain soup method for counting neurons. Before her experiments, it was assumed that all brains were built the same. Now we know that they aren't. I wouldn't exactly call this a myth, but it certainly was an assumption that has been proven wrong. This, of course, brings us back to the blockbuster discovery that the human brain contains on average 86 billion neurons rather than 100 billion. It turns out there was really no source for this 100 billion. And the lesson here is don't be afraid to read critically and ask where a fact came from. Meanwhile, they're also discovering that bird brains have many more neurons than expected. And there is even the strange case of the elephant, which although it has three times as many neurons as a human, most of these are in the cerebellum, not in the cortex. So to review a few of the surprises, first of all, not all brains are built the same. Second, not all neurons are the same size, which I guess means that an expert ought to be able to tell from a microscope slide what animal they're looking at from the size of its neurons. Another surprise was that the number of glial cells is surprisingly constant, probably because the way that they are added has not changed. And finally, there's the issue of folding. It turns out that cortical folding doesn't necessarily reflect the number of neurons. So what is the human advantage? Dr. Herculano Huzel says it's the fact that we have 16 billion neurons in our cortex, which is more than any other species, and probably made possible by the discovery of cooking, because this allows us to get enough energy to support those neurons. I always ask guests about advice for students, and I was really interested to hear what she would say, given the fact that I think she's a wonderful role model for questioning assumptions and being creative, but knowing the literature. And what she said was, read everything. Read what you agree with. Read what you disagree with, but read critically. I would love to hear your thoughts about this episode. You can send me email at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com or post an audio comment at speakpipe.com/Doc Artemis. Brain Science is independently produced and it relies on the support of listeners like you. There are three ways you can support the show. One is the premium subscription for $5 a month, which gives you complete access to the back catalog and episode transcripts. Second, which is popular with long-term listeners, is Patreon, patreon.com/Doc Artemis, which allows you to choose a monthly contribution. And finally, you can make a direct donation via PayPal or mail. You can learn about all these options at brainsciencepodcast.com/donations. Of course, even if you can't support the show financially, you can help by sharing the show with others, either through social media or in person, and especially by leaving reviews and subscribing in iTunes. It turns out that subscribing in iTunes is a big deal because it helps keep the show highly ranked so that more people will find it. So please subscribe in iTunes, even if you listen in another podcasting app or you listen in the free Brain Science mobile app. When you're on the website at brainsciencepodcast.com, I hope you'll sign up for the newsletter, which is free and gets you the show notes automatically every time an episode is released. This is a good thing to do because Brain Science is not on a exactly regular schedule right now, and you can be sure that you won't miss an episode. I'm actually getting ready to move at the beginning of May. And so the next episode I expect to produce should come out in June of 2017. After that, I'm really hoping to resume a monthly production schedule. In the meantime, I want to thank you for listening, and I really look forward to talking with you again very soon. Brain Science is copyright 2017 to Virginia Campbell, MD. You may copy this to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at brainsciencepodcast@gmail.com.